Hey guys, how's it going?
You know, I think I would prefer a solid minute of dead air before my show to The Onion. I'm sorry to start every top of the hour segment on this show with how much I hate The Onion. But seriously, that's supposed to be funny? That a foot-long sub is too much for a person? I've been able to eat a foot-long sub from Subway since I was 12 years old or something. And I'm a skinny little runt of a man, too. And happy to admit it. But that's supposed to be hilarious satire. Wow, we interviewed the CEO of Subway and he said, "Geez, you mean you got single people eating a whole sandwich?" You're just splitting my side open with hilarity, guys. Hilarity. What the hell happened to them? The guys that wrote Our Dumb Century. I don't get it. You know what? Maybe I've completely lost my sense of humor, and that's the problem. But I don't think so. I think that The Onion is just not funny at all anymore. That's supposed to be a joke? I would prefer a full minute of dead silence before Ricky's theme starts playing. I probably wouldn't lose any more listeners than I'm losing to those damned Onion pretend newscasts. My God, man. Ian Freeman, can you hear me? No more Onion, please. Hey, how about news, guys? Do another minute of news. Daryl, give me some more news, man. I don't want to hear The Onion no more. It ain't funny. It ain't satire. There ain't no humor in it. It's just stupid. Here's an Onion headline. Al-Shabaab killed a bunch of people yesterday. Hilarious, right? Yeah, they were all screaming in pain as they died. Ha 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 ha. That could pass for comedy. For The Onion now, don't you think? Anyway, welcome to the show. It's the Scott Horton Hates The Onion show. And wishes horrible things to be overly vague about it. To happen to all the people who write this stupid crap that's supposed to be their satire. Jeez, we had no idea that people could eat a whole sandwich by themselves. Really? Someone came up with that, then they wrote out the script, and then they produced it. They had their sound guy master it, they had the audio guys come in and record a few different takes, and then they put it out to the world. Oh, this one's gold, man. This one's great. I think I'd rather hear Benjamin Netanyahu cry about the Iran nuclear deal than supposed satire from The Onion. Any more. For God's sake. Yes, welcome to my show. The waste of time. What's the point in listening? All he does is talk about how much he hates The Onion show. Isn't it interesting? Sorry, I know it's not. I'm sorry. All right, well, anyway, I got a bunch of news for you. Ramzi Baroud is going to be on to talk about Palestine. And, man, I'm sorry, I don't cover Palestine nearly enough. I've had Ramzi Baroud and Rula, what's her last name, I forget, and this other lady who made this great documentary that someone had sent me that I watched all about Palestine. And I keep trying, and it's hard to get him on the show, man. But Ramzi Baroud, he's going to be back on the show. He's a Palestinian refugee living, I think, in England now. Though he travels around a bit. He's a Palestinian. He has the right of return. Just because the Israelis deny it to him doesn't mean it's not his right. Of course it is. So we're going to be talking a bit about that with Ramsey Baruth here in just a little while. And then, man, I'm really hoping that we get Trita Areza on from the NIAC to talk about the nuclear deal. If not, perhaps Reese Ehrlich could do the show. But the Iran nuclear deal, of course, the story broke during the show yesterday. So even though we were talking with Gareth and talking with Phil Giraldi, we didn't have all the details. So we're going to try to get some details out here. Explain to you what is the dang deal with the thing. It's too close to the break, but in the next segment, I'll go through a bit of the facts for you. And maybe that'll wait, actually. I'll talk about a bit of the reaction. Maybe we'll go through some of the details of the actual agreement. I don't know, man. I might could read this in a 10-minute segment for you here. Parameters for a joint comprehensive plan of action regarding the Islamic Republic of Iran's nuclear program. Now, the thing of it is that it's a much more comprehensive kind of a thing than was expected. But on the other hand, it's still not the final deal. The final deal won't be signed and hands shook and all of that until June, the end of June. So, but as predicted, I think, as I predicted, the politics have really shifted in favor of the President of the United States at this point. And the leading indicator of that is this story by Josh Rogan and Eli Lake. And I know you're supposed to spit when somebody says the words Eli Lake. Josh Rogan, I like him. Now, I know that he's a hawk. He's a very kind of, he's best buddies with Eli Lake. And he's got a kind of neocon view of the world. But unlike Eli Lake, Josh Rogan is not a liar. Eli Lake is a liar. But Josh Rogan, he does good journalism, man. I can't really, I disagree with his point of view on some things sometimes. When he talks about his point of view, I think, oh, come on. But as far as his journalism, I can't think of a time where I caught him getting wrong on a fact or nothing, man. He does a pretty good job. And so it's a good thing they put his name first. Here he is at Bloomberg News, writing with Eli Lake, spit. Skeptical Senate puts new Iran sanctions on hold. President Barack Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry have won a three-month reprieve from the threat of additional congressional sanctions on Iran with the announcement Thursday of a political framework for a nuclear agreement. Senator Mark Kirk, the Republican co-author of a bill imposing more sanctions against Iran, told us after Obama's speech that he did not expect to vote on the legislation he wrote with Democrat Robert Menendez before June 30th. That's the deadline the U.S., Iran, and five other great powers have set to finish negotiations for a final nuclear agreement. Obama and Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, had warned that passage of those sanctions would destroy the nuclear talks. Quote, I think we will give them until the end of June, Kirk told us. He also insisted that the framework deal was more generous to the Iranians than Chamberlain's offer to Hitler at Munich. Oh, God. As Daniel Larrison says at the American Conservative magazine, this ought to, in any decent and reasonable society of adults, would read Mark Kirk right out of this discussion. Okay, you're a kook. Everything you say is stupid and wrong, so piss off, Mark Kirk. You freak. But of course, this isn't a reasonable society run by adults whatsoever. So tiny little crying children like Mark Kirk have quite a bit of say in the way things go and the way things are perceived, the way things are debated in this society, unfortunately. But anyway, blah, 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 Munich, blah, 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 1938. And that Congress would be, quote, an overwatching presence in the coming months as negotiators continued the talks. The delay of the Kirk Menendez bill doesn't mean the fight between the White House and Congress over Iran will wait till July. Quite the contrary. A bill written by Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker and supported by Rand Paul that would mandate a congressional review of any deal is still moving forward. The White House had warned that this legislation, too, would harm negotiations. But at least the worst one, the Kirk Menendez, are on hold, and politics seem to be shifting toward the president and his pseudo-peace deal here. Back in just a sec, y'all. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free.
Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audio book of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back. What's wrong with this thing, man? All right. Hey, so Ramsey Barut is coming on to talk about Palestine here in just a few minutes. I'm over here checking my footnotes with Gareth during the break. Now, here's one thing that I called Gareth this morning and I said, hey, now that you know the terms of the deal, is there anything that you would change or amend from what you said on the show yesterday? And there is a change, but it wasn't enough to do a whole new interview about. But he clarified that the Americans had apparently dropped the demand that the IAEA would have to give their so-called absolute and complete clean bill of health to every last aspect of the Iranian program, which, as he said, could take as much as 10 years if you went by the complete overkill standard that they used on South Africa back when. And how, no, apparently they have dropped that. And, in fact, they're willing to lift pretty much all the sanctions, not in a phased sequence, but pretty much right away, as soon as it's verified that Iran is going along with the program. And then the second thing is, and this is not a change, but this is just a point of clarification, because you might have seen the warmongers crying all day yesterday about this deal on Twitter and other places, saying, oh, the possible military dimensions aren't even in there. Well, yes, of course they are. And the possible military dimensions, we all know, are already a complete and total fraud. The so-called smoking laptop, the so-called alleged studies, manufactured lies by the Israelis, as Gareth Porter has shown for years and years to be the case. But anyway, let me see if I can plow through as much of this deal as I can in 6 minutes for you here. Below are the key parameters of the thing. Enrichment. Iran has agreed to reduce by approximately two-thirds its installed centrifuges. Iran will go from having about 19,000 installed today to 6,104 under the deal, with only 5,060 of these enriching uranium for 10 years. All six out, the others will be, those are at Natanz, the others will be at COM, and that'll just be for research. All 6,104 centrifuges will be IR-1s, Iran's first generation centrifuge. Iran has agreed to not enrich uranium over 3.67% for at least 15 years. Iran has agreed to reduce its current stockpile of about 10,000 kilograms of low-enriched uranium to 300 kilograms of 3.6% LEU for 15 years. That's low-enriched uranium for 15 years. All excess centrifuges and enrichment infrastructure will be placed in IAEA-monitored storage and will be used only as replacements for operating centrifuges and equipment. Before, they had said, well, we want to keep everything, but we'll just unplug the tubes connecting them and whatever. No, they agreed to go ahead and remove them even from Natanz. Iran has agreed to not build any new facilities for the purpose of enriching uranium for 15 years. Iran's breakout timeline, the time that it would take for Iran to acquire enough fissile material for one weapon, not to make one, but just to have enough material, is currently assessed to be 2 to 3 months. That timeline will be extended to at least 1 year for a duration of at least 10 years under this framework. Iran will convert its facility at Fordo so it is no longer used to enrich uranium. Iran has agreed to not enrich uranium at its Fordo facility for at least 15 years. Iran has agreed to convert its Fordo facility that it has used for peaceful purposes only into Nuclear Physics Technology Research Center, into a Nuclear Physics Technology and Research Center. And it'll it won't be even uranium. They'll be using, as it says here, they'll be using
other compounds. Iran has agreed to not conduct research and development associated with uranium enrichment at Fordo for 15 years. Iran will not have any fissile material at Fordo for 15 years. Almost two-thirds of Fordo's centrifuges and infrastructure will be removed. The remaining centrifuges will not enrich uranium. All centrifuges and related infrastructure will be placed under IAEA monitoring. And so this Fordo is the one that's under the mountain and much harder to bomb, the one that the Americans and Israelis are much more concerned about. So completely neutralized there. Iran will only enrich uranium at the Natanz facility with only 5,060 IR-1 first-generation centrifuges for 10 years. Iran has agreed to only enrich uranium using its first-generation IR-1 model centrifuges for 10 years, removing its more advanced centrifuges. Iran will remove the 1,000 IR-2 centrifuges currently installed at Natanz and place them in IAEA-monitored storage for 10 years. Iran will not use its IR-2, IR-4, IR-5, IR-6, or IR-8 models to produce enriched uranium for at least 10 years. Iran will engage in limited research and development with its advanced centrifuges according to a schedule and parameters which have been agreed to by the P5+1. For 10 years, enrichment and enrichment research and development will be limited to ensure a breakout timeline of at least 1 year. Beyond 10 years, Iran will abide by its enrichment and enrichment R&D plan submitted to the IAEA and pursuant to the JCPOA, that's, I don't know what the hell it is, under the additional protocol, resulting in certain limitations on enrichment capacity. The IAEA will have regular access to all of Iran's nuclear facilities, including to Iran's enrichment facility at Natanz and its former enrichment facility at Fordo, and including the use of the most up-to-date modern monitoring technologies. Inspectors will have access to the supply chain that supports Iran's nuclear program. The new transparency and inspection mechanisms will closely monitor materials and/or components to prevent diversion to a secret program. Inspectors will have access to uranium mines and continuous surveillance at uranium mills, where Iran produces yellow cake for 15 years. So from womb to tomb, the entire thing, IAEA will be there. Inspectors will have continuous surveillance of Iran's centrifuge rotors and bellows production and storage facilities. So even where they're making the centrifuges, they'll have access to that. Their manufacturing base will be frozen and under continuous surveillance. All centrifuges and enrichment infrastructure removed from Fordo and Natanz will be placed under continuous monitoring by the IAEA. A dedicated procurement channel for Iran's nuclear program will be established to monitor and approve on a case-by-case basis the supply, sale, or transfer to Iran of certain nuclear-related and dual-use materials and technology, an additional transparency measure. Iran has agreed to implement the additional protocol to their safeguards agreement with the IAEA, providing the IAEA much greater access and information regarding Iran's nuclear program, including both declared and undeclared facilities. Iran will be required to grant access to the IAEA to investigate suspicious sites or allegations of covert enrichment facility, conversion facility, centrifuge production facility, or yellow cake production facility anywhere in the country. Iran has agreed to implement modified code 3.1, requiring early notification of construction of new facilities. Iran will implement an agreed set of measures to address the IAEA's concerns regarding the possible military dimensions of its programs. That's about halfway through there. The rest will have to wait to a later segment. When we get back, Ramzi Baroud on Palestine and its future. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, eye on the empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, well, goddamn hell, man. I guess the Ramsey Baroud thing fell through for now. I'll try him again in half an hour. Well, good, because I wasn't done with this yet. Iran has agreed to implement modified Code 3.1, requiring early notification of construction of new facilities. That's what they were accused of being in violation of back in 2009 when they declared the COM facility. But according to them, before the controversy over COM, they were no longer bound by 3.1 or the additional protocol, which they had only been bound by under their agreement with the E3 from 2003 through 2005. And then when the Americans refused to back up the E3 thingamajiggy, they withdrew from it. And the additional protocol, in fact, had never even been ratified by their parliament. They were just going along with it anyway. You know, Scott Ritter's new piece goes into this a little bit, too. But anyway, so we're going through what all the Iranians have agreed to. They've agreed to implement the additional protocol, their safeguards agreement, which will give the IAEA access to things related and slightly tangentially possibly related to facilities where actual nuclear material is being introduced into the equipment, which is the basis of the basic safeguards agreement. And then modified 3.1 says, before you even start digging a hole in the ground, you better tell us that you're gonna. Of course, when they were so-called outed 4 days after they declared the COM facility back in 2009, COM was still just a hole in the ground. And they said, come on out, inspectors. And Mohammed Al-Barada and the guys went out to inspect, and they said, yes, just a hole in the ground. So even if the lawyers want to quibble about 3.1, some of the IAEA lawyers say that, no, you're not allowed to withdraw from subsidiary arrangement or agreement 3.1. And the Iranians said, yes, we are too. There was nothing going on. There was no secret enrichment facility or anything. It was just a hole in the ground at the time. And as Glenn Greenwald showed, and I keep linking to this because it's great, and he was the one who just nailed it down. I was screaming about it on the show, but he wrote it, that they have this ridiculous lie, that the only reason the Iranians even declared their hole in the ground at COM was because they knew somehow, I don't know, maybe with magic, that Obama was about to expose the fact that they had this facility. And Glenn Greenwald called that the still unproven, what is it called? I have it right here. The still missing central fact in the Iran drama. Glenn Greenwald, October 7th, 2009. Oh, yeah? How in the world could Iran have known what Obama was going to say at a press conference in 4 days? Did anyone even pretend to believe that Iran had spies on Obama's speechwriting staff? Greenwald quotes the New York Times saying, well, you know, anonymous administration officials believe and then don't even say why they believe it. Yeah, very convincing. And does it make any sense at all? No. Okay, thank you. Iran has agreed to redesign and rebuild a heavy water research reactor in Arak, that's A-R-A-K, Arak, based on a design that is agreed to by the P5+1, which will not produce weapons-grade plutonium, and which will support peaceful nuclear research and radioisotope production. Never mind the fact that even if it did produce plutonium, they would have to take the lid off. They'd have to let it cool. They'd have to turn the thing off, let it cool for a year, take the lid off of the whole damn factory, and harvest all the weapons-grade plutonium out of there, and then they would need a reprocessing facility that they do not have in order to reprocess that nuclear waste into weapons fuel, which would be absolutely impossible to do in secret, of course. Give me a break. So that never was a threat, but they're going ahead and taking care of it anyway. Thank you. The original core of the reactor, which would have enabled the production of significant quantities of weapons-grade plutonium, will be destroyed or removed from the country.
Iran will ship all of its spent fuel from the reactor out of the country for the reactor's lifetime. They already had a deal with the Russians to do that anyway. Iran has committed indefinitely to not conduct reprocessing or reprocessing research and development on spent nuclear fuel. Iran will not accumulate heavy water in excess of the needs of the modified Arak reactor and will sell any remaining heavy water on the international market for 15 years. Iran will not build any additional heavy water reactors for 15 years. Sanctions. Iran will receive sanctions relief if it verifiably abides by its commitments. U.S. and EU nuclear-related sanctions will be suspended after the IAEA has verified that Iran has taken all of its key nuclear-related steps. If at any time Iran fails to fulfill its commitments, these sanctions will snap back into place. The architecture of U.S. nuclear-related sanctions on Iran will be retained for much of the duration of the deal and allow for snapback of sanctions in the event of significant non-performance. Keyword there, architecture. They'll have it all set, but suspended. All past UN Security Council resolutions on the Iran nuclear issue will be lifted simultaneously with the completion by Iran of nuclear-related actions addressing all key concerns: enrichment, Fordo, Arak, the possible military dimensions, and transparency. However, core provisions in the UN Security Council resolutions, those that deal with transfers of sensitive technologies and activities, will be reestablished by a new UN Security Council resolution that will endorse... Oh, the JCPOA, that's the Joint Plan of Action thing. That was what I couldn't figure out a minute ago. That will endorse the Joint Plan of Action and urge its full implementation. It will also create the procurement channel mentioned above, which will serve as a key transparency measure. Important restrictions on conventional arms and ballistic missiles, as well as provisions that allow for related cargo inspections and asset freezes, will be incorporated by this new resolution. A dispute resolution process will be specified, which enables any JCPOA participant to seek to resolve disagreements about the performance of JCPOA commitments. JCPOA commitments. If an issue of significant non-performance cannot be resolved through that process, then all previous UN sanctions could be reimposed. UN sanctions on Iran for terrorism, human rights abuses, and ballistic missiles will remain in place under the deal. Phasing. For 10 years, Iran will limit domestic enrichment capacity and research. I go so fast that I end up screwing up and taking even longer to get through it. I'm sorry. For 10 years, Iran will limit domestic enrichment capacity and research and development, ensuring a breakout timeline of at least 1 year. Beyond that, Iran will be bound by its longer-term enrichment and enrichment research and development plan it shared with the P5+1. For 15 years, Iran will limit additional elements of its program. For instance, Iran will not build new enrichment facilities or heavy water reactors and will limit its stockpile of enriched uranium and accept enhanced transparency procedures. Important inspection and transparency measures will continue well beyond 15 years. Iran's adherence to the additional protocol of the IAEA is permanent, including its significant access and transparency obligations. The robust inspections of Iran's uranium supply chain will last for 25 years. Even after the period of the most stringent limitations on Iran's nuclear program, Iran will remain a party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which prohibits Iran's development or acquisition of nuclear weapons and requires IAEA safeguards on its nuclear program. Deal. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. So, despite all my screwing up reading, that was it. The parameters for a joint comprehensive plan of action. That was the C in there. The joint comprehensive plan of action regarding the Islamic Republic of Iran's nuclear program. All right. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Reese Ehrlich is going to be on the show a little bit later to talk about the Iran nuclear program. So that worked out. That's good. 1:30. And then I'll have Ramzi Baroud for at least one segment here in a little while. So I'm not sure if these are actually different headlines or not. One is they're both at the Hill. One is Israeli cabinet united against Iran deal, and the other is GOP rips Iran's nuclear deal. Yeah, that's because they're a bunch of traitors, a bunch of lousy traitors who put Israel before their own country, who put Israel before truth, logic, reason, honesty of any kind. John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader, they both went to Israel to get their marching orders just in the last 2 weeks. And they're going to do everything they can, apparently, to try to ruin this deal. Because they want a war. Because that's what Israel wants. Iran was never making nuclear weapons in the first place. They were already members in good standing of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. People want to quibble about, oh, whether they violated Subsidiary Arrangement 3.1 in not declaring the COM facility early enough. Even if that's right, which it's not, who freaking cares? They never made 1 ounce of weapons-grade uranium there. Or anywhere. They're not in violation of the NPT, which guarantees their, quote, unalienable right to peaceful nuclear technology. This whole thing is a manufactured crisis. And in fact, oh hell, I don't know if I have it here. I guess I don't have it here anymore, but there's an interview in Haaretz yesterday with this historian who says, come on, we all know that the entire Iran issue is just a distraction from the Palestine issue. As long as the Israelis are pretending to cry and be afraid of Iran, then they're changing the subject quite effectively from their oppression of their occupied helots in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. And hell, it's not even a secret. I was actually pretty happily surprised to see him reaffirming exactly what it was that Gareth Porter said in his book, that Yitzhak Rabin started warmongering against Iran to distract from the fact that he wanted to give up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem to be a Palestinian state. He said, yes, it's true, I want to make peace, but look, everybody, Iran threat. Well, then someone took Benjamin Netanyahu's word that Rabin was a traitor, literally, and shot him and killed him. Assassinated and murdered him, because that was what Benjamin Netanyahu wanted. And so then, not much later, Netanyahu himself came to power. I think there was, I guess Shimon Peres. Wouldn't Peres became the prime minister for a minute there, and then Netanyahu came to power for the first time back in 1996. And he decided to do the same scam as Yitzhak Rabin, only for the opposite reason. There will never be a Palestinian state. All of the West Bank, so-called Judea and Samaria, will belong to the Israelis forever. All of Jerusalem will belong to the Israelis forever. and we'll never have peace, and the people of Palestine can all just go die. And look, everybody, Iran, a nuclear threat from Iran. He was lying all along. It was just PR all along to distract from their endless oppression, torture, and murder, and land rustling in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. As simple as that. And it's good to see an Israeli historian interviewed in Haaretz making that perfectly clear. That's exactly what is going on here. It's just a great distraction from their oppression of the Palestinians. And that's why they're screaming and crying about this now. Because otherwise, we're going to have to get back to Ramzi Baroud and his point of view. How Palestinians can defeat apartheid. You know, the way Flint and Hillary Mann Leverett counted it up anyway, Israeli Arabs, so-called, are already a majority, or at least it's about a 50-50 split if you count the 20% of Israeli citizens who are Palestinian, Christians, and Muslims. If you count the occupied in the Golan Heights, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, it's about a 50-50 split. And yet when it comes to who's allowed to vote inside Israel, it's an 80-20 split, super-duper majority. And that was why they kicked almost a million Palestinians out of what we now call Israel proper back in 1948. So that they could have a Jewish state and a democracy at the same time and not have to worry that the Palestinians that they didn't quite succeed in kicking out would ever have any real political power. And so they haven't. They've maintained that 80-20 split. But if you go ahead and just accept the fact that it is already de facto one state, then it's an apartheid state. Just like in South Africa. Just like in Mississippi and South Carolina during Jim Crow, where the oppressed, powerless, excluded from political power population are at least a 50-50 split or even the majority. And, you know, this is a choice that the Israelis have made. Ehud Barak, who was the former prime minister, who I guess succeeded Netanyahu the first time, he called it apartheid himself. He said, listen, we have a choice. If we don't give up the West Bank, and this was when he was Netanyahu's defense minister, he said, if we don't give up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, then we'll be an apartheid state. And that can't last. Not in this day and age. So we have to decide, do we want to be a democracy or do we want to be a Jewish state? And what the population of Israel has decided is that they don't want to decide. They want to keep the status quo. And yet they can't. Because the more settlements that they put in the West Bank, especially, the more impossible it becomes to think that they will ever give it up, that there'll ever be a second state. And I don't want to give away too much of the Ramzi Baroud interview, but that's his point, is that in Netanyahu's reelection, in order to make sure he got reelected, he disavowed the possibility that there ever would be a Palestinian state on the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And we all knew that that was his position, that's Likud's official position, and that was his father's position, and that when he said otherwise, even with all the caveats about what this supposed state would be like, that he was lying. And when he disavowed the possibility that there would ever be a Palestinian state, he was telling the truth. All you have to do, hell, go and read in the New Republic. They did a great write-up of John Kerry's failed peace efforts there and how he really did do his best, John Kerry, back in 2012 and 13, and the Israelis just simply said, go to hell, over and over and over again. They pretended, oh yeah, we'll cooperate, and then they absolutely refused to cooperate in any way.
No maps. Why do you have a map open? No maps allowed. We're not at the point where we're talking about maps yet.
What?
There was no negotiation because the Israelis, they have no good faith. And they were not acting in good faith. They're just land rustlers. That's all. And so, Beirut is saying, good, fine. Now we have one state. Now we can get to the real point of this entire population excluded from the political power that rules them. How do you call it a democracy when half the people subject to it have no say whatsoever, huh?
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com.
All right, well, that wasn't funny, but I'll admit it was a bit apropos for this conversation anyway. On the line, I've got Ramsey Baroud from RamseyBaroud.net. He's a media consultant, an internationally syndicated columnist, and editor of PalestineChronicle.com. His latest book is My Father Was a Freedom Fighter, Gaza's Untold Story. His latest article at antiwar.com is called How Palestinians Can Defeat Apartheid. Welcome back to the show, Ramsey. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back, Scott.
Very happy to have you back on the show here, and very happy to address this subject matter with you, or have you address it for us. A lot of stuff happened in the recent Palestinian elections that seemed to really change the game in a sense. And I guess the most important of those was Netanyahu's brief moment of honesty there when he said, look, there's never going to be a second Palestinian state. We're never going to allow there to be a Palestinian state. All of Israel belongs to us from Jordan to the sea, the Jordan River to the sea, etc. And so screw the Palestinians. And then he tried to walk that back, but nobody believed the walk back. Everyone knew that he was telling the truth when he said that. But so it seems like you're kind of looking at the silver lining on Netanyahu's honesty about his horrible policy. How's that?
Right. I think Netanyahu surprised everyone, his supporters included, with that statement. Of course, the statement came out of complete panic.
Wait. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but your phone sounds absolutely terrible. I got you good and loud here, so if you could please hold it a little bit further away, maybe the wind won't distort on the mic.
Absolutely. Can you hear me better now?
A little bit better, yeah. But I got you good and loud, so you could hold it plenty far away, okay?
Oh, okay, great.
Okay, thank you.
So basically, Netanyahu's honesty surprised a lot of people, including his own supporters. Not that they were not familiar with his rhetoric or with his, you know, actual practical policies that no Palestinian states will be established, and also the racist rant that happened just before the election. But the fact that he actually articulated it, the idea was, we all knew that from the very beginning. The Americans knew that as well. They knew that Netanyahu had no intentions of ever going back to the peace process or allowing a Palestinian state to be established, etc. But the fact is, he wasn't supposed to say it. He said it because he was in panic. He panicked because exit polls or the last polls that were conducted just before the elections showed that the Zionist bloc, you know, the Labor Party and their allies, were actually neck to neck with Netanyahu. He thought it's over for him if he doesn't come up with something that is so strong and so powerful that is going to pull in the right-wing constituency around him. And he did, succeeded in doing so, but of course he exposed the farce that we've all known from the very beginning.
Right. And yeah, I'm sorry, we got a real problem with the phone there. You're not on any kind of headphones or anything, right?
Not really, no.
It's just the plain old telephone handset?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess I'll ask you to maybe hold the mouthpiece just up near your eyes. Just go ahead and hold it way away from your mouth, and I'll make sure to have
It's the microphone on your phone is distorting is the problem. But sure. I'll have you good and loud here. But if you could just hold that thing as far away from your mouth as you possibly could, please, sir. Because I'd hate for people to not want to listen through the whole thing. He was desperate. He came out and he admitted the truth that really it is one state. But so now what for the Palestinians, Ramsey? Now I'm sorry, I lost you completely. Now, maybe we went a little too far with that one. I'm sorry, man. I'm trying to. We got to find a way to split the difference here, Ramsey, so we can hear you.
Okay. How about now?
Yeah, that sounds perfect, right there.
Okay, great. I'll keep it at this distance then.
Okay, good deal.
So basically, the Palestinians now have to really contend with this reality. Mahmoud Abbas, you know, the head of the Palestinian Authority, and his entourage. I mean, they are keenly interested in maintaining the Shawad. They want it because they are making a lot of money. They are becoming rich, millionaires, at the expense of the suffering Palestinians. But they can't maintain that Shawad any longer. Netanyahu kind of really pulled the rug from underneath their feet. And now they have to accept the fact that the Palestinians are running out of patience. But my message was really to Palestinian intellectuals and people who are speaking outside that corrupt circle of the Palestinian Authority to really kind of congregate and start to think, not around peace process discourses, not around, you know, this kind of old mantras and slogans, but to rather face the facts the way they are. We are put in an extremely tough position here. There is no peace process, nothing to be expected from Netanyahu, his government, or frankly, even his opponents, even those who are supposedly the liberals and the Labour Party. They are actually quite as bad, except that they are much softer in how they articulate that quite terrible policies that they have. So Palestinians have got to, you know, use some introspection here, think outside that whole peace process, charade, and think of ways to unify their rank politically, but also unify the narrative. Our narrative is really quite disconnected at this point between Hamas and Fatah and people who are in diaspora and people who are at home, Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship, millions of refugees. You know, so the narrative is becoming quite disjointed, frankly. And we can't deny this anymore. We can't just pretend, no, everything is fine and we carry on with our lives. We've got to actually think of an alternative way to repair that Palestinian identity in order for us to actually be able to deal with this reality created by Netanyahu's becoming a prime minister for the fourth time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very important how you point out in here about all the, I guess, millions now of Palestinians living in refugee camps in Syria, Lebanon, and everywhere else, and their right of return. And you're not talking about, well, they can come back to the West Bank. You're saying so-called Israel proper, that, hey, as long as it's one state, it's time for these people to be allowed to come home. And, you know, I guess I'll go ahead and cut right to the chase here. I'm afraid that if it ever comes to the point where the Israeli Jews have to choose between a democratic state or killing all the Palestinians in another Nakba, another Trail of Tears type forced march, kick all the Gazans out, force them into the Sinai Peninsula, drown all the citizens of the West Bank in the Jordan River or whatever, that they'll just do that. That they'll be damned if they're going to ever give up their 80-20 supermajority, just as much as they'll be damned if they're going to ever give up the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip at all. And so I wonder whether, even though, I mean, it sounds absolutely crazy, hell, they did it before, and it's crazy what they're doing now with the permanent occupation, and I wonder whether maybe if there's a real declaration of, hey, this is one state, and we all want one man, one vote, and we all want to participate, we want equal rights, that they'll just kill y'all.
Well, the problem, Scott, of course, I agree with you that they see this as a worst case scenario, and they are, most of them are not even open for even to dialogue. around the principle. But the issue here, the problem is not created by us. It's created by Israel. For 20 years, the peace process has been kind of sidelined. The central issue that matters to Palestinians, Jerusalem, the right of return for Palestinian refugees, territorial integrity, sovereignty, even their economy, they can't even control what do they import and what do they export. Even the taxes that are collected on their behalf are also collected on, you know, by Israel, which they use to manipulate the Palestinians. You know, you kind of play along, then we give you the money that we owe you. You don't play along, then we'll hold it. So you are near starvation, then we'll give you a little bit, and so forth and so on. So it's not like Palestinians really have so many options, and they are kind of selecting the most difficult of these options. There is a reality, and that reality has been created by the Israeli occupation. And the Palestinians now find themselves living with Jews between the river and the sea. The only thing that really that makes this a not one-state solution is the fact that the laws, there are two sets of laws. One applies to Jews, one applies to Arabs. Mm-hmm. And the Arabs are being discriminated against, and they are being expelled from their land and so forth and so on. So would it be more reasonable to think of this impossible scenario in which 500,000 Israeli Jews is being, you know, evicted out of the West Bank, entire cities demolished that are the current settlements, and a whole host of, you know, these fantastic ideas that most likely will never happen, as opposed to, well, this is the reality. We are already living on this land. Why can't we share? Why can't we streamline the laws so that they would apply on both of us equally, as opposed to create segregation that, again, at this point, it really is impossible to create, and it's impossible because Israel made it impossible, maybe at one point in the past, maybe in 1967. It was still a possibility. Maybe earlier it was still a possibility. Even when Oslo was signed in 1993, maybe it was still a possibility. But this, at this point, if you look at the map and the way that the settlements is basically are basically scattered throughout the West Bank, where Palestinians are living in Israel and Israelis living in Palestine, where the right of return can never be achieved unless there is a level of territorial integrity for Palestine, and all of these things have become impossible because of the occupation. So if Israelis find themselves having to make these drastic decisions of another Nakba, another ethnic cleansing of Palestine, that's their problem. They have created that situation, and they are accountable to international law and to humanitarian laws in this regard.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I guess the is it your position that Oslo was always a scam, even under Yitzhak Rabin? If he had not been assassinated, do you think it would have even been possible to have the two-state solution then?
It really has always been a scam. And I remember, Scott, when I was still a kid, I mean, I was 19, 20 years old at the time, and I remember protesting in the town of Ramallah as a student at the a local university there, with a whole bunch of kids basically protested against it, saying it's a scam, and this is exactly what happened. Everything that we said was going to happen, in fact, happened. Even the economic part of the agreement signed in Paris in 1995, even that was not respected. Forget about sovereignty and right of return and Jerusalem and all of these really, really tough decisions. Even the fact that Palestinians cannot export their yogurts or their beer or import anything from Jordan without going through Israel, even that, the Paris Protocol of 95, none of that was implemented. So from the very get-go, that scam was really written all over this deal. I just don't know how they managed to sustain it for 20 years.
Right. Well, now, so let me ask you this, because I read recently that the West Bank settlements, especially, that they're all the recipients of massive subsidies from the government. And, of course, they're protected by the IDF way out there on the frontier in somebody else's land and that kind of thing. So it seemed like, in a way, that could just be turned off like a switch, and that if they don't get their subsidies, they'll have to come back to the other side of the green line. And that maybe, assuming the political will was there in Israel, that they wanted to choose to be a Jewish state
and a democracy still, and that they realize the only way to do that would be to give up the West Bank, that even the right-wing zealots out there in the occupied territories, they would really have no choice but to come home if the subsidies were just shut off. Is that outside the realm of possibility now?
I think it is outside the realm of possibility, not because it's not possible, but because there is no debate in Israel about the identity. I mean, at least among the Jewish communities in Israel, there is no debate about the Jewish identity of Israel. There is near total consensus within the right wing, the ultra-nationalists, the left wing, the Orthodox. Everyone is in agreement regarding that. None of them think that the settlements should be abandoned at any point. In fact, the settlements, especially in the so-called Greater Jerusalem area, the ones in the north, the ones in the center, they have been so incorporated into so-called Israel proper, to the extent that many of the settlers living there are actually not even religious or nationalist or Zionist in that sense. These are people who are looking for cheap housing because of the subsidies that you just spoke about. Mm. So it's not like there is this disconnect between the settlements and Israel. It has, you know, been incorporated into Israel in terms of the economy, in terms of the geography, in terms of the body politic in general, to the extent that there is really no discussion there whatsoever. Not like, you know, in a year or so they will realize, wow, we have to make a choice between being democracy or being Jewish, and we have to do, you know, to take some drastic measures. Mm-hmm. That has never really been in you know, part of the discussion in Israel, and I doubt that it will ever be, really, until they are confronted by Palestinians on one hand, but also by the international community that allowed this to carry on for so long.
Right. Okay, now listen, I know that you have to go, and I've kept you over time here, but I sure do appreciate you coming back on the show, Ramsey. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Scott. You take care.
You too. All right, y'all, that's the great Ramsey Baroud. You can find him at original.antiwar.com/Ramsey-Baroud and RamseyBaroud.net and Palestine Chronicle. His latest book is My Father Was a Freedom Fighter. His latest article is called How Palestinians Can Defeat Apartheid. And the one before that is Netanyahu the Mythbuster. Special relationship, no more. And sorry, I know that you guys missed a big segment of that. I kept him through the commercial break there because he was in a hurry, and I had screwed up the times here and everything. And so, but I wanted to get as much of that conversation accomplished as I could here. Reese Ehrlich will be coming up here in just a few to talk about the Iran nuclear deal with us here. Hey, if you want to see Reese Ehrlich and myself on video, just check out my YouTube channel. We did this thing back in 2010 about Iran, where he was really the featured speaker talking about his book. And then I joined him on the panel discussion after the fact. And there was also a neocon who was completely full of it. It was a lot of fun, really. You may have seen that video of me. It's called Iran Propaganda Debunked in 6 Minutes or something like that. And that's where that's from. And you can find the whole thing at youtube.com/Scott Horton Show. It's like an hour and a half or something. And it's Reese Ehrlich and myself, and a really good thing if you want to check that out. Boy, I have so much different stuff to talk about here on the show today and so little time. I think, let me hit refresh on antiwar.com. I mean, if you know, this really should be emphasized that al-Shabaab killed 147 people yesterday in an attack on a university in Kenya. This is the worst attack since al-Qaeda blew up our embassy there in 1998, and it's sure to mean real backlash. Now, I know you're wondering, but why would al-Shabaab attack Kenya? Well, it's because Kenya is occupying Somalia. That's why. Because America is paying them to do it. And so this is, well, you can't really call it blowback. It's just backdraft. Blew up right in their face again, just like the mall attack from, what, a year and a half ago or whatever. So it's an absolute catastrophe. 147 people killed. And
I guess we have to predict will lead to further intervention in Somalia, when, of course, this whole crisis is all America's fault in the first place. Again, check out my awesome article at fff.org, U.S. government to blame for Somalia's misery. And yes, that includes hundreds of thousands of people who starved to death in a famine there. It was mostly Mother Nature's fault, except that it was mostly America's fault. Because, you know, in a market economy, famines are obliterated by prices in exchange. But when America smashes a country into a million little pieces and they have no market, when hardly any farmers even have the ability to sow some crops, and the ones that don't fail, they're unable to get to the market. And if they can get it to the market, the literal market, nobody can afford to buy it all because America smashed the hell out of their country as per the Ladine Doctrine. You gotta take a little helpless country and slam it up against the wall every 10 years or so just to show you mean business. Michael Ladine, quoted by Jonah Goldberg in the National Review there. Hundreds of thousands of people starved to death, half of them children under 5 years old. That's right. George W. Bush and Barack Obama starved to death hundreds of thousands of little bitty helpless children because they're the worst people in the whole world. And anyway, so that's why Somalia sucks. And that's why Al-Shabaab is even a force in Somalia whatsoever. And then now, so Amnesty probes Iraqi forces' abuses into Crete. Really need to get somebody on. I can't seem to get a hold of Prothero, but let's see if I can get somebody on to cover the battle for Tikrit, which seems like it's mostly over. Although maybe not quite. And, well, as this headline says, as ISIS withdraws Iraq, that should be quote-unquote Iraq, Shiistan, faces a real test of holding Tikrit. I think it's going to be a real test to see whether they attempt to populate Tikrit with a bunch of Shia and steal it, or whether they're just going to be content in driving out the Islamic State and then letting the rest of the population come home. The rest of the population who they consider to be ISIS anyway, just for being Sunnis. So, I guess if I had to place my bets, I don't know where they'll get them all. But if I had to place my bets, I would assume that it's Iran and their sock puppet militia's policy to cleanse Tikrit of Sunnis and replace them with Shia. And although if they do that, it's going to make taking Fallujah and Mosul and Ramadi and the rest of the cities under ISIS control that much more difficult. But then again, they've already, haven't they already proven what happens to the Sunnis when they're liberated from the rule of the Islamic State, from some of the smaller towns in the Anbar province? The answer is yes. So I guess we'll see about that. And now in domestic police state news, very quickly, you may have seen that the FBI entrapped two New York women into saying they love Osama and discussing bombs. As always, you can read the great Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. All of these terror busts are big fake FBI entrapment jobs. Everybody knows that. Oh, orange alert me to death. I'm so freaking scared. Give me a break. Something really blows up. That might be something, but nah.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
How can you shoot women, children?
Easy. You just don't need them so much. Ain't war hell?
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And the sound bite's coming in handy, helping me fill a little bit of dead air there. All right, on the line, I got Reese Ehrlich. And boy, oh boy, I wish I had his bio in front of me. Hang on, I'm paging down here. I got it. Reese Ehrlich, he is the author of a great many books about the Middle East. He's a hardcore war reporter, spends a lot of time over there. He wrote most recently the Iran Agenda, the real story of U.S. policy and the Middle East crisis. And he recently wrote the piece, Lifting U.S. Sanctions to Iran's Satisfaction Won't Be Easy. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Reese?
I'm doing great. Just an update, I do have a more recent book called Inside Syria.
Oh, right.
The backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. But I've been following stuff in Middle East and Iran for a long time.
That's right. I'm sorry about that. I knew that about the Inside Syria, which I still haven't read, but I sure would like to read. Boy, if you could see my list of books I'm supposed to be reading, it's just out of control here. Anyway,
tell me the truth. Do you take those books that you receive for free and take them down to the bookstore and sell them off?
No, they sit here in a giant pile behind me, and they go nowhere. They do nothing. I read half of them, and then I put them down, and then I never do interview the damn authors of them, and it's a catastrophe. I read articles all day, and I just... And then what I'll do is I'll dedicate an entire weekend to reading a 500-page book, and then the author won't do the show after I spend the whole damn weekend reading that.
Little do people know the anguish that radio show hosts go through.
It's not easy, man.
It's just a simple job. You show up, and you ask a bunch of questions.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a lot tougher than that.
Yeah, no, it is an absolute catastrophe over here, man. I can't ever keep up. Maybe if I was a professor and I could do one of them sabbatical things where I get paid to not work for a year, then I could catch up. That'd be great. Anyway, enough about me. Let's talk about the Iran nuclear deal. What do you think?
I think it's a big step forward. If the final agreement contains the elements that are in the preliminary one, it's a win-win for both Iran and for the U.S. And frankly, the Iranians gave up a lot more than anybody had been expecting. Their nuclear program will be very much constrained to producing uranium and facilities for making nuclear power and eliminating any possibility down the line of making a nuclear bomb. So it's what the U.S. wanted to do, and the Iranians are apparently willing to make the concessions.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, so we all know that Iran is a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and as such, they have a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which has, quote, continued to verify the non-diversion of declared nuclear material in Iran to any military or other special purpose, I think 19 million times, something like that. And so what was the controversy even going into these talks, Reese?
Well, that's what I write about in my article, which is that actually, if you take a step back, Iran has no nuclear bomb. That's agreed to by everybody. It has no nuclear weapons program. That's agreed to by the United States and the European countries. So why impose these crippling sanctions in the first place? Why are we even in these negotiations? Well, because the U.S., Israel, and the European powers don't like what Iran is doing in Syria, in Lebanon, and other parts of the Middle East. It's a regional power engaged in backing its allies. And that's the real reason that these sanctions were imposed. And the bomb issue, the nuclear issue, was the convenient excuse. It was like the weapons of mass destruction argument used to attack Iran. You have to find some issue that gets people really, really, really scared, really worried, and, oh, my God, mad mullahs with atomic bombs. We've got to do something to stop them. Well, it was basically invented. It was certainly exaggerated. and that's the backstory to this.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the big fake red herring, the big, the outstanding issue, no matter how made up it was, preventing any kind of rapprochement between the United States and Iran. But so what's the opposite of that? I saw that, well, I didn't see the whole thing or read the transcript, but the headlines were that the president of Iran this morning gave a speech where he said, you know, we'd like to go ahead and be friends and warm up relations with all of our adversaries. And he seemed to be talking about America, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and everybody else. I wonder whether you think that now that this gigantic fake manufactured crisis is out of the way or mostly out of the way, whether this really can be the beginning of the end of the Cold War with Iran.
Well, I'd like to think that's the case, but I doubt it, frankly. And it's not for lack of trying by the Iranians. The U.S., both liberals and conservatives, doves and hawks, have pretty much agreed that Iran it can't be trusted, and it's shown up on the nuclear issue, but it's also, for example, in the statement that the U.S. issued yesterday about the talks, it made it clear that the U.S. wasn't going to lift sanctions having to do with human rights and arms trafficking. The U.S. has a temporary alliance with Iran right now in Iraq because both are fighting the Islamic State, the extremist group using Islam as a cover. But the U.S. is very much on other the opposite sides in Syria, in Lebanon, and now in Yemen. So I don't think I think while it's a step forward on the nuclear issue and hopefully will lower tensions and the prospects for a U.S. or Israeli attack on Iran, the other differences aren't going away anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, now, so I'm actually more worried about the Saims at this point. We all know that George Bush fought a war for the Ayatollah in Iraq for 8 years there and, you know, helped them kill 1 million people to kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad and turn that into a, 85 or 90% Shiite city now under their control. And as they're fighting the Islamic State, America's providing the Quds force with air cover into Crete and so forth. And I know that we're still, America and Israel and our allies are still on the side of Al-Qaeda in Syria while we're fighting with the Iranians.
And don't forget Yemen now, too.
In the east, yeah. But so, do you think I'm right to worry about that, that we're going to go too far in allying with Iran again, like in the George W. Bush years inside the war in Iraq? Because we're hearing all kinds of stories of atrocities at the hands of the Badr Brigade and the other Shiite militias under American air cover.
Yeah, that one is the full screenplay is yet to be written, frankly. I think the U.S. is improvising as it goes along. It doesn't have a strategic plan at the moment, and it's aligned temporarily with anybody that it thinks can help out in the short run. So in Iraq, having lost the war previously under George Bush, remember it wasn't Obama, but it was Bush who lost the war in Iraq and signed an agreement with the Iraqi government to pull out all the U.S. troops. And the net result of that war, as you pointed out, was to make Iran stronger. And the Iraqi government is more closely allied with Iran than it is with the U.S. I don't think that's the situation the U.S. faces. And if they're going to defeat the Islamic State, they got to have allies somewhere. And all those allies, with the exception of the Kurds, are probably going to be somewhat friendly to Iran. And so I don't think it's a strategic plan by the United States to cooperate with Iran, but a tactical one. And where it ends up, I don't even think the people in Washington know.
Yeah, well, that certainly wouldn't surprise me. But now, okay, so you brought up Yemen there, and man, I hear all the time, Reese, that, oh, everybody knows, like Saddam's nuclear weapons program, everybody knows Iran is backing the Houthis in Yemen. Is that really true? Do you even know of any anecdotes about that being the case?
Well, what it turns out is how you define back. And the implication, and certainly the Saudis have claimed and the U.S. have claimed that the Houthis are agents of Iran, and they're being funded and armed by Iran. That's certainly not true. It sounds like we're going to head for a break.
Yep, we'll be right back after this with Reese Ehrlich. He's at Global Post. Lifting U.S. sanctions to Iran's satisfaction won't be easy, is his latest. Just a sec. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation.
And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, Al Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm sorry, I'm off on a tangent here, asking Reese Ehrlich about Iran's role in Yemen, but it's important. It's a major talking point of the war party right now. They're on the march. Not that they've marched into Iraq. It was Bush that marched into Iraq and gave it to them. It was Israel that created Hezbollah by invading Lebanon and staying throughout the 1980s and 90s. Damascus has been under the control of the Alawites and the Shiites all along. So, just because Netanyahu says something doesn't really mean it's true. Probably means the opposite. But they say that's the talking point anyway. Iran is on the march all across the Middle East. And we got interrupted by the break there. You were addressing the Iranian role in Yemen there, Reese.
Yeah, they politically support the Houthis, which are an indigenous rebel group opposed to the U.S., opposed to Saudi Arabia and Israel, and currently allied with the former dictator, Saleh. So it's not like there's a bunch of good guys and bad guys there, but the Saudi air attacks and possible ground invasion is going to make the situation and is making it much, much worse. First of all, there's a huge humanitarian crisis where they're bombing civilians. They've blockaded, set up a naval blockade and closed the airports. So the life for civilians is very difficult. And sooner or later, meanwhile, the Houthis are making great gains on the ground. And as a result, Saudi Arabia and Egypt may well have to send in ground troops, which is going to make the war even more expanded. So you can't cry, oh, my God, we're protecting the country against Iran, when, in fact, you're the invading force. And the U.S., as usual, is on the wrong side on this and is backing Saudi Arabia with intelligence and aerial surveillance and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And now when you say supporting them politically, are they sending them money and guns and artillery?
Well,
or what are they doing?
I've seen no credible reports about arming them, nor sending. They may be sending them money, although I've seen no accurate reports about that. For sure, politically, they support them and have for a long time. And so their media support, writes favorably. The foreign ministry talks favorably about them. But for sure, the Houthis are not pawns or tools or proxies for Iran. That is absolutely the case. They've got their own agenda. They claim they want to bring fair elections and a fairer system to Yemen, which I have my doubts about. But in any case, they're not acting as proxies for Iran.
Yeah. And by the way, speaking of the Saudis, there have been some threats in the media the Saudis, if Obama does this nuclear deal with Iran, they might just buy some nuclear weapons from Pakistan, or they might just go ahead and embark on a nuclear weapons program of their own, and it'll be all Obama's fault for starting a massive arms race in the Middle East.
Well, that's, I think, the kind of hype that is put out there to try and discourage having any kind of an agreement with Iran. Saudi Arabia is closely allied with the U.S. If the U.S. said, you can't do it, and we're going to break relations if you do, the Saudis would never do that. And so I think it's one of the threats that's out there to make people very, that's exaggerated to make people worried.
And I guess they have less reason to be worried now. The Saudis would have less reason to be worried now about the Iranian nuclear program than at any time since 2004 or 5, right?
Exactly. In other words, let's say these talks had broken down and everybody went home. Iran, although I don't think they wanted to develop a nuclear program, certainly from the eyes of Saudi Arabia and the U.S. and Israel, would be freer to do so than they are now. So these folks who are so hawkish should be glad that Iran has made these concessions and is constrained as it is. If you have a moment, I'd like to talk about some of the pitfalls that we're probably going to see in the coming days. Overall, the agreement, I think, is a good one. There's three areas you've got to keep an eye on in the weeks ahead, because the final agreement won't be agreed on until the end of June. So one is, what will allow the sanctions against Iran to be lifted? The agreement, as it's spelled out so far, says Iran has to live up to a bunch of commitments in terms of limiting its nuclear capabilities, its enrichment of uranium, and so on, and something called PMD, or possible military dimensions. Your listeners may be familiar with the laptop of death and some of these other arcane things that have been mentioned in the past. Basically, the U.S. claims and Israel claims that Iran had a secret program to develop nuclear weapons, and until they come clean on that, they can't be trusted. And now that PMD has worked into the agreement, and the sanctions won't be lifted until this PMD issue is resolved. That's a huge point of disagreement, because basically it would allow the U.S., and particularly a future president, if this stretches beyond Obama's term, to prohibit lifting the sanctions, saying, oh, this PMD issue isn't resolved. Believe me, in the weeks ahead, there's going to be a lot of hard negotiating and possibly changing of that wording, because otherwise Iran could possibly make all these changes in its nuclear program and still not get anywhere in terms of lifting sanctions.
They do say in here that they've agreed to resolve all the possible military dimensions accusations, which we all already know are bogus anyway.
Right. Well, that's so. It could, if it was on the most positive way, the U.S. and the IAEA could say, "Yep, Iran didn't have this program, and that clears it. And the Security Council is now free to lift the sanctions." But if somebody wants to make trouble, remember, the IAEA, after 10 years of investigating Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, never concluded that the program had ended. And that was at the U.S. instigation, and that was one of the key excuses used to attack Iraq. Oh, we don't know. We think they still have weapons of mass destruction, and the IAEA has never ruled otherwise. So the U.S. can exert a lot of pressure if it wants to disrupt the agreement, whatever is written on paper.
I see. And, okay, so I'm sorry, go ahead.
All right, so, and then the final, so one is the PMD, two is the sanctions, and the third area is the so-called snapback, which is the Obama administration made a big deal about how if the sanctions are violated later, they can snap back and reimpose them. Except, in order to do that at the UN level, they'd have to have the agreement of China and Russia, and that seems highly unlikely. So I think conservatives in Congress are going to know that, and they're going to raise the issue and say, aha, once the sanctions are lifted, the Iranians will be free to break it any way they want, and the snapback is won't actually ever happen. Yeah. So those are the three areas that I think we'll see a lot of debate about in the upcoming weeks.
Yeah, I saw David Ignatius in his column today, the CIA writer for the Post, was pointing out, he didn't really explain what he meant, but I guess that's what he was talking about when he said that the UN sanctions snapback amounts to a nightmare, that Russia-China issue there.
Exactly. It probably won't happen, but that's a heavy argument. Remember, the statement that came out of the White House yesterday was written for an American audience to convince Congress and others, Israeli supporters in the U.S. and so on, that this is really a tough agreement, and they had to fudge partly to do that.
Yeah, well, so, and now I guess on as far as the sanctions, what Obama can waive himself and what he needs cooperation from, I guess the most recent reporting I've heard is that it seems perhaps unlikely that they'll be able to get veto-proof majorities in both houses. And I saw Josh Rogan is reporting that at least Kirk Menendez, the worst of the new sanctions, have been put on hold till at least the end of the deal there. But do you think that Congress really will have the power to obstruct Obama? I mean, after all, the politics have really shifted toward Dear Leader at this point, right?
Well, it's going to be down to the wire, because there are people in Congress, and particularly the Netanyahu government in Israel and its supporters in the U.S., who don't want any agreement. There's no agreement that would be big enough, good enough, because you can't trust the Iranians. That's the way they look at it, even though the Iranians have done everything they were supposed to do for the last year and a half while these talks have gone on. So those folks, if they can make alliances with less extreme, shall we say, hawks, they could throw up some roadblocks. They want Congress to vote on this issue, even though Ronald Reagan reached an agreement with Iran without a congressional vote, a little detail that's left out of the narrative. Presidents all the time have reached negotiated deals with foreign powers without having a congressional vote. If it's not a treaty, it doesn't need a vote. So I think that we're going to see this sharp debate, and it'll come down to the wire. At the moment, I think the agreement has tilted things in Obama's favor. Mm-hmm. And I think the momentum so far is with Obama.
All right, and now you point out in your article here, lifting U.S. sanctions to Iran's satisfaction won't be easy, at the Global Post, that, hey, even if they had some weapons-grade material, the ability to make an actual nuclear weapon out of it, a usable one, is an entirely different question. As my friend Gordon Prather, the nuclear weapons physicist, likes to say, let me know when they have an equivalent of the Sandia or Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories that they could come up with any kind of actual workable nuclear device. I mean, when people say breakout time, they're talking about a pile of weapons-grade uranium, not an actual weapon.
Exactly, and that's part of the hype, and you've got to be very scared of the Mad Mullah's argument that's so distorted the discussion in the U.S. and in parts of other parts of the world. The building an atomic bomb is actually very complicated, and you can look to North Korea, which supposedly had its breakout. And it's not clear to this day if they've got an operational atomic bomb, because they tested them and they failed, and they it's very complicated. You have to, first of all, you have to have plutonium enriched to 90%, or uranium that's plutonium. Then you have to miniaturize it so that it can fit on a missile head, and then you have to figure out how to trigger it. You can't just stick a fuse in the uranium and light it. It's a very complicated process, and Iran doesn't know how to do it. And then even if you have a nuclear bomb, you've got to test it somewhere. So all along the way, if any of that happened, the U.S. would know about it. And the idea that Iran could do this in secret and somehow accrue a nuclear arsenal unbeknownst to the West and then use it, let alone use it to attack somebody, is just farcical, frankly.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks very much for coming back on the show, Reese. I sure appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right, Joe, that's Reese Ehrlich. He's at the Global Post here, lifting U.S. sanctions to Iran's satisfaction won't be easy. His latest book is Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. And we're over time. See you tomorrow. No, see you Monday. No, see you Sunday morning on KPFK.